Blog Talk Radio.
From the San Francisco Bay Area, it's time for Live from the Bay with Joey. Joey's guest today is Shelley Morrison, well known as Rosario from that hit television series, Will and Grace. Here's Joey.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Live from the Bay with Joey, and we have such a great and exciting show for you this evening. Joining us will be none other than Shelley Morrison, well known as Rosario from the hit television series Will and Grace. She also played the role of Sister Sixto on The Flying Nun, if you remember that. She is a Hollywood legend with many, many movies and television credits. And, you know, Shelley will talk to us today not only about her career and future projects that she's working on, but also about some other things that are her passion. So great and exciting stuff. And we'll also be joined by Shelley's husband, Hollywood filmmaker and director Walter Dominguez. So make sure you tune in, call your friends and your family about this, and it's time to listen on in. And before we go and meet Shelley, we're going to cover some hot topics that we're going to go over, some interesting and newsworthy items that deserve or perhaps do not deserve our attention. You decide. And before we do that, I want to send out a shout-out to my friends and boys over at Starbucks in Menlo Park, California on the Alameda. Shout-out to Eric, Marco, Obi, Jose, Anita, Tyler, and Ray, and our in-house friends, Fidel and Rexola. This place is one of my favorite spots due to their friendliness and their staff over there. So let's show them some love. And Jammin, are you there with us?
Hi, Joey.
How are ya?
I'm doing great. How are you tonight?
I'm really, really excited. It's going to be a great show. And you know what? We're going to go over some hot topics. But the way I want to do it tonight, it might be a little bit different. I think we're going to go over just a couple, you and I, real quickly, because I don't want to make Shelley and Walter wait a long time. And then I'll go and do an intro on Shelley, and we'll get the show started. How does that grab you?
Let's do it.
Okay. So it's time for us to talk some hot topic, so I think we should just, what do you think, crank it up?
Yes, we should.
We're just gonna crank it up, crank it up! So, you know, Jammin, I don't know if you saw this. This was a little bit disturbing to me. Today, I heard about this heavy metal singer who hails from Southern California. His name is Tim Lambesis, who happens to be a heavy metal star, and he was arrested over an alleged murder-for-hire plot of his wife or his ex-wife, and I think this was in San Diego County. Did you hear about this?
I saw that on the Yahoo. It came across the screen there.
Unreal. And you know what really makes it sad is that he's a heavy metal singer, and you know, and he has a band, and he's traveled all over the world. And then on top of that, he adds that he's a Christian. And you know, I think that just really gives a bad name for Christians all over the world. And, you know, I don't know the whole thing. I don't know what his story is. I just hope and pray for him that there's no fact to it, that it's fiction. But it really does sound, I mean, they arrested him. So it doesn't sound like a good situation. So I don't want to talk too much about that, but that was kind of a sad story for me to hear about. And then, you know, I'm sure it's sad for all of us, but definitely that was something that really just gripped home to me. And then also, I don't know if you heard about this deadly giant snail that was found in Houston, Texas.
No, a deadly giant snail.
Oh, my God. Yeah, it's huge, right? So this thing, I mean, it looks like, I don't know, it's huge. It's nasty looking and it's ugly. If you go to Houston, make sure you just stay away from this thing. I mean, it's enormous. It's probably the size of somebody's hand. And they're actually from Africa, but they are deadly because they carry the meningitis virus. So, again, something that is pretty scary. I just think of all the times that we've got snails and, you know, of course, California, we're just filled with them here. But I just think of all the snails that I see every single day. So, you know, seeing this and hearing about it just freaked me out. So I just, I don't know. But anyway, I just thought I'd talk to you about that. We're gonna share some more interesting hot topics. But you know, I'm wondering, Jammin, do you remember? And folks, just listen up and tell me if you remember this voice.
You promised me one Friday off a month. Talk to the boob.
Okay, but of course, and right now we all know who that is, right? So tonight we're really excited to have with us Shelley Morrison, along with her husband, Hollywood film writer and director Walter Dominguez. Shelley Morrison has had a remarkable, fascinating 40-plus-year career in show business, from co-starring in feature films of the likes of Hollywood legends Gregory Peck, William Holden, Anthony Quinn, to co-starring on one of the television's most acclaimed situation comedies. This woman that's of Hispanic descent, born and raised in the Bronx in New York City, whose first language was Spanish, whose parents were Spanish Jews from Turkey, who now embraces the spiritual tradition of the Lakota Sioux. Morrison, of course, better known as Rosario, the feisty maid on NBC's hit comedy series Will and Grace, is here with us now. And folks, it's an honor and joy to introduce to you tonight on Live from the Bay with Joey, well known to many as Rosario Inez Consuelo Yolanda Salazar McFarlane, also known as Rosie or Roro from Will and Grace, actress Shelley Morrison. Shelley, welcome, and how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great for an old broad. Hi,
for
guys.
Old...
How you doing?
I'm doing good. This is such a great pleasure and honor to have you with us. We're looking forward to hearing about your early life in the Bronx, your movement from New York to California, your great 40-plus year career, current and future projects, as well as other things that you are passionate about. So first off, let's start talking about your life, your early life in the Bronx,
wait,
New York.
Wait, you said 40 years. On my union
plus.
Card, it says member since 1958.
Since 19 what?
58.
Oh, my gosh. So we're talking, well, I said 40 plus, so that's right.
It's a lot plus.
And well, okay, how 50 plus?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's amazing. That's amazing. But you still look great. So I want to – let's go back in time. Let's take you back to your early life in the Bronx, New York, shall we? Now, I'm familiar with the Bronx since my dad was from New York and he was brought up in the boroughs of New York. I understand that that's where you were from. And at an early age, you were speaking Spanish or Latino. Is that right?
Latino.
Latino. Okay, tell me about that.
Well, my parents spoke Latino in the house. They spoke a number of languages. They spoke French. They spoke Latino. They spoke some Italian, Greek. And the kids in the neighborhood, I lived in a tenement, 80 families in one building.
Mm.
And when they couldn't understand me, they used to pinch me.
Mm.
And so there was a teacher that lived on the fourth floor, Nettie. And my father took me upstairs for her to teach me how to speak English phonetically. And so by 4 years old, I was reading in English.
Mm-hmm.
And the first thing that I read to my parents, and I was so proud,
mm-hmm.
was View of Gone with the Wind.
Oh.
And then I learned by heart the Gettysburg Address.
Wow.
And
you were,
so
you...
that was pretty cool. So I was bilingual. And... I spoke English to the kids there, but when the family got together, we would speak in Latino, and I've kept the language through the years.
Now, that's awesome. So can you tell the audience, because there's a lot of people that are not going to be familiar with what Latino is, and we're not saying Latino, we're saying Latino, L-A-D-I-N-O. So can you please let people know what that's about?
The words are very similar, but as my husband, who speaks Spanish, for eyes would say ojos, and I would say ojos. For woman, he would say mujer. I would say mujer. So it sounded a little Portuguese.
Mm-hmm.
There were a lot of other words, a lot of phrases because the Spanish Jews, when they were expelled from Spain during the Inquisition, fled to numerous countries. So you have a little bit of Greek in there. You have a little Italian in there, and it's a pastiche.
Right, right.
The swear words are wonderful. I won't say them on the air in case anybody knows them, but they are so vivid. And when I'm driving and someone cuts me off, I just take off swearing in Ladino.
I see. Well, we're not going to do that, but I will say I remember reading a story. Now, this is not in my script tonight, but off the cuff, let's see how good my memory is. You had a parrot in New York. His name was Chico. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Now, you tell me that story with the rabbi, please.
Oh, my goodness, because someone might know what I'm saying in Ladino.
Is it going to be bad?
It's pretty bad, but what the hell?
Okay, what the hell?
I was teaching Chico how to speak. I'd have him on my finger, and I would say, "My name is Chico. My name is Chico." Well, my father would go around the house sometimes swearing. If something bothered him, he would swear. Well, the rabbi and his wife came over to have a cup of tea, and they're sitting in the dining room. And in the bedroom, there's Chico going, "My name is Chico, Chico, a stebok, a stebok," which means go screw yourself.
Oh.
The rabbi is saying, what is that? Where is that coming from?
Oh,
and
my
I
gosh.
Thought my father was going to roast that bird that night, but he didn't.
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
No.
You know, it's funny hearing about it. What stood in my mind, my aunt and uncle used to have, and my uncle was a preacher, but they used to have a parrot, and actually my grandfather gave them the parrot. His name was Juanito. And Juanito was originally, he came over, and he was a little bird. He came over from Mexico, but he soon adopted a Spanish accent. So he, and my family was from southern Spain, so he spoke like an Andalusian Spaniard. And then he would sing flamenco. And then if you saw Juanito, and he would cry, and then the only thing to pacify him was bread, like
aww,
some sourdough bread dipped in coffee. He would love that. And then when you left, he would raise his little paw and say goodbye, goodbye, bye, bye.
Ooh.
And oh yeah, and he sung in Spanish, and he cried, and he was just an amazing bird. So when I hear about, you know, stories like Chico, it so reminds me of my aunt and uncle's parrot. So thank you for sharing that story.
We have immortalized Chico, so he'll feel good. He's buried in the garden.
Okay, there we go. So as a little kid between 1967 and 70, I remember seeing The Flying Nun. You were one of my favorite characters on that show. Now, can you tell me how you landed that role as Sister Sixto, and
it's spelled S-I-X-T-O, but it's pronounced Sisto. S-I-S-T-O.
Okay, Sisto. Okay, and how and whom you patterned? I understand you patterned or modeled that role after an aunt. Is that correct?
Yes, my aunt Rosie.
Okay, and I want to know how you landed.
I called my aunt Tanti, my Tanti Rosa.
Okay.
But the thing was, I was under contract to Screen Gems and Columbia. That was the old contract system where they put you in everything. And they asked me to assist with the tests for the pilot. And I was assisting, helping other actresses, you know, read for different parts. And Bob Claver, who was the producer of The Farmer's Daughter, who was a good friend, came walking in when I was doing all the tests, and he went over to the boss, Harry Ackerman. He says, "What's he doing testing her? She should just play it." And that's how I got the part. I was supposed to be only in the pilot. And when they were testing the show, they have these preview houses, and they used to put these little sensors on your wrists to get your reaction to laughter or whatever. And every time I came on the screen, the needle would go off the chart.
Mm.
They signed me to do the show.
That's awesome. That is awesome. That is
wonderful.
Awesome.
It was.
Yeah.
And Sally Field, what an incredibly talented. I mean, you could just tell it that I'm 10 years older than she is.
Mm-hmm.
And the talent just blinded you. And it was difficult. She was only 21 when we did the show,
mm-hmm,
the pilot.
Mm-hmm.
But I visualized incredible things for her. She's an amazing, amazing amazing talent and an amazing mother.
Mm-hmm. She seems like a good soul. So that's, you know,
yeah.
you can just see that. Now, let's go back to, okay, so now after that, well, I guess during that time frame, too, 1969, I understand you played the role of a squaw in the movie starring Gregory Peck titled McKenna's Gold. And I heard a cute little story about what happened on the set between you and Gregory Peck in makeup. Is that right? Can you tell me about that?
Every incredible character actor in Hollywood was in that film. Eli Wallach, Telly Savalas, Burgess Meredith, Raymond Massey, Anthony Quayle, Edward G. Robinson, on and on and on. An incredible cast. And here I am looking, you know, pretty gringy, playing a Pima squaw. And every morning in the makeup room, Mr. Peck would say, "Good morning, Shelley." And every morning I would say, "Oh, my God, it's Gregory Peck." And I would crack him up every morning. And we had this one scene where he had to be tied to a post. And the director, the whole cast was in that scene, and we were there by the campfire, and it was going on, you know, longer than sorrow.
Mm.
And Gregory was tied to this post, and you could tell he was tired, and the director wasn't helping things any. And I was sitting close by him on the ground, and I found some black, a piece of black paper on
mm-hmm.
the ground there.
Mm-hmm.
I took it, and I put it in my front teeth.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just smiled at him, and God bless him, he just cracked up.
That's
so
great.
Anything, you know, to break the ice and make people feel more comfortable. I like to make people laugh.
Yeah, that's very apparent, so that's awesome. Now, I understand, so you've been married to Walter Dominguez, whom we're going to meet in a little while, it's going on 40 years,
mm-hmm.
and I know that you just both got done working on a feature film or documentary together. I also, if I understand correctly, you began, and we were just talking about your role as a squad, but you began to really look at exploring the traditions of the Lakota Sioux Indian. Is that correct?
That was in 1981. My mother had just passed away, and my husband and I took care of my mother at home.
Uh-huh.
And she died in her own bed, bless her
mm-hmm.
heart,
mm-hmm.
with the two of us holding her and my nephew.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really kind of very empty for me. I had lost so many of my relatives, my father, so many other. And it's almost like we were led by the hand where we should be. We went to a medicine wheel gathering and met these incredible elders,
mm-hmm.
Wallace Black Elk and Bearheart Marcellus Williams. And the philosophy of the Lakota Sioux, or the Red Road, the Red Path, it generated something within us that everyone and everything is sacred. So it really cuts to the chase. And we started doing the Anipis, the sweat lodges, and the vision quests. My husband's a sun dancer. And I remember at first, and we'd go camping in the middle of nowhere on sacred land to do all these ceremonies. And it's what kept me grounded.
Hmm.
Excuse me, and my husband.
Hmm.
Because Hollywood can be very strange.
Mm-hmm.
You can start believing the hype
mm-hmm.
and lose sight of who you are.
Mm-hmm.
And we have the same community that we had back in 1981.
Mm-hmm.
Still do the sweat lodges. We still do the ceremonies.
Mm-hmm.
And if anyone is in trouble or sick or needs help,
uh-huh.
we circle the wagons. And on the film that we just finished, our documentary,
mm-hmm.
A majority of the people who have worked on this film with us,
mm-hmm.
Sound editors, cinematographers,
mm-hmm.
editors, we've known them for over 25 years. So it's a good path because you get down to the essential of what really is important, what
mm-hmm.
really matters.
Mm-hmm.
I've lived in the same house since 1946.
Mm-hmm.
here in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. And it's you get down to what the values are. And people say that I make them laugh. Well, it's not me that's doing it. You try to keep yourself clear so the spirits can work through you. So that's why I've been very careful the material I've chosen, because I don't want to ask for help for my spirit guides to do garbage.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to do anything that's going to pollute. I don't want to do anything that's going to damage someone.
Mm-hmm.
And people will say, you know, well, just take the money and run. I can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
I can't do that. And
mm-hmm.
I was ready to give it all up before Will and Grace.
Mm-hmm.
Bearheart came out to do a sweat lodge, and he said, with his Oklahoma accent, he said, Shelley, when you get into the sweat lodge, I want you to be very specific what you would like to do. And so we got into the lodge, and he said, Shelley, say your prayers.
Mm-hmm.
And I spelled it out. You know, mm-hmm. I would like to be in something that really well written,
mm-hmm.
A comedy, a Fifth
mm-hmm.
Banana,
mm-hmm.
And if at all possible, in front of a live audience.
Mm-hmm.
It was a Sunday night.
Mm-hmm.
On Tuesday, I got a call to audition for Rosario.
Mm-hmm.
Went in.
Mm-hmm.
To see Max and David's, the creators of the show. They're brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
As I walked in, because the part totally resonated with me,
mm-hmm.
I grabbed a chair, dragged it over to where they were sitting, and I said, is this going to take long? I have to go home and cook a chicken.
That's funny.
Got in the car. My agent called. I said, how did it go? He said, you start tomorrow.
Oh, that's awesome. See?
It was meant to be.
Yeah.
It was meant to be. And the cast... Everybody, it was extraordinary. It was lightning in a bottle.
Right.
The most important thing is that it said something. It said something, and it was a watershed moment. And Joe Biden has talked about Will and Grace, how that has helped in so many ways with a whole gay, lesbian, LGBT, what do you get, all the letters.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'm half asleep right now. But
that's all right.
To be in something that meant something to people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, boy, that's a gift.
Right, right. I'm very, you know, when you were talking about, you know, specifically praying and asking for things that that you want, I totally believe that. You know, Jammin's heard, our audio producers, he's heard this story tons and tons of times before, and he's probably plugging his ears because he's so sick of hearing it. But you don't know. I mean, my background, I'm a singer, a songwriter, an actor, and I remember years ago, I wanted to do a film or appear in a film with Penelope Cruz. You know who she is, right?
Love her.
Yeah, so I envisioned this. I saw it in my quiet time. You know, I actually saw myself working on the set with her. So about a couple weeks after I had seen this, and it was like right in between, you know, when you're falling asleep, you're not really asleep yet, but you're kind of in that state. And so a couple of weeks later, I got a call from an agent in San Francisco. And he said, Joey, he said, we ran across your picture and blah, blah, blah. And there's this actress. She's very famous in her own country, but not really famous here. She's getting well known. She's going to be doing a movie, and part of it's going to be filmed in San Francisco. She's supposed to portray a Brazilian girl. It's called Women on Top, and every time I tell people that, they think it's a porno. It's not. But they said that, you know, we'd love you to consider it. And I said, okay. And they said, you probably never have heard of the actress. I said, well, who's the actress? And they said, it's Penelope Cruz. So I'm like, yeah, I'm right there. So I was fortunate enough to do some work on that film, and it was great. So I believe that totally. I believe that if you want something bad enough and you send it out there, that if it's meant to happen, it will happen. And also garbage movies, garbage music, garbage anything around you that's not supposed to be in your parameter, like you said, you don't want around you. So you should know those things that are going to be those things that are real good, you know, for your soul and for moving on in your progression in life. So I thank you so much for sharing that with me and that story. Now, I understand that you have adopted quite a few children. Is that correct
They're
from
not
that
children
tradition?
Anymore. They're grown. We had our elder, Bearhart, I guess this is about 15, 20 years ago with some of them. All of them have parents. Their parents live far away. So Bearhart had a ceremony for us to be their spiritual parents. And they now are married. They have children of their own. And they're in and out of this house all the time. And there are kids. And their parents are very grateful to us for being, for having a safe place for them here.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And two of them are sun dancers.
Wow.
Billy has completed his 5-year pledge. Anthony's completed 2 years. And they're extraordinary. And Desi, who's one of our spiritual grandchildren,
mm-hmm.
who's 10 years old, and he has a band, and he's
mm-hmm.
terrific. And it's very, oh, what can I say? The sun shines brightest on the tree that bears the most fruit.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the running of the bulls between our spiritual kids and grandkids and Walter's family. We do a lot of family gatherings.
That's
you know,
awesome.
At a drop of a hat, you know, if someone has a head cold, you know, we do a gathering, you know.
Wow. Well, you know what? If I was in L.A., I would want you to adopt this Spanish-Italian kid. How about that?
Terrific.
I would.
I'm a good cook, too. And
what's
I cook,
that?
I'm a good cook. I cook a lot of the Sephardic dishes.
Hey, there you go.
Yeah.
There you go.
Good for you. It's the Mediterranean diet is what
yeah,
it is.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm sure a lot of the Sephardic dishes still hold some of the tradition from Spain when they left, huh? I'm sure there's some things that they still hold that are similar.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
I would assume. We
eat a lot of vegetables.
Yeah.
And a lot of grains.
Yeah.
And wine, vino, it's good for you.
Vino.
At night, terrific.
Yeah, that is terrific. Well, I heard that in 2006, you started doing, you joined the cast of Disney's Channel's continuing animated series, Handy Manny.
Yeah,
the voice
oh,
of Mrs. Portillo.
I
right?
did it, what, for 6 years?
Wow.
Oh, I loved Mrs. Portillo. Oh, she was so sweet.
Yeah.
And she was my Aunt Rose. That was my Aunt Rose, honest to God. That was... I would, and she's passed, and I miss her terribly.
Right.
Oh, my well, goodness. I remember, I don't know if I can say this on the air, but what the hell. After my first mastectomy, it was difficult. And my Aunt Rose, tiny little thing, came up to me, and she said, Shelley, Walter can still make love to you with one teta.
That's pretty funny.
Oh, she was so sweet.
And for those that don't know what a teta is, they can email you and get that answer. Okay. So then I understand that you provided the voice of Mrs. Sanchez in, it was a DreamWorks?
Shark Tale.
Shark Tale, starring Will Smith, Jack Black, Angelina Jolie.
And Marty Scorsese. I had the sequence with Marty, which was very much fun.
Wow. What's the difference? I mean, what's it like? It must be surreal. I mean, what's it like seeing yourself on the screen and, you know, your this animated character with your voice or the voice that you're doing? That must be, like, totally different, right?
I've done voiceovers for years, and it's just another aspect of what you can do. Some people have the ear for it. I love it because it brings out the child in you, and,
mm-hmm.
and you just... you can create things and with your voice,
mm-hmm.
and it's just another tool in your tool chest.
Mm-hmm.
I've done westerns. I mean, I had my own horse at Universal when I was doing a show called Laredo
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
with Neville Brand and William Smith, and
mm-hmm.
You know, you trained. I was a dancer for many years.
Mm-hmm.
These are all tools that you had in doing a lot of stage work. And 65 plays.
Wow.
What is it? Winter stock, summer stock, bus and truck companies, national road companies. So I love the work. I love the thing about creating.
Right.
If you get something on paper and it's like it's there it is on paper and you want to keep the author's intent, but it's creating something. So that's why in many ways I'm not acting now, is because the material that they're offering me, been there, done that, did it better. If George Clooney or Brad Pitt, who I really admire their work, came up to me and said, Shelley, here's a script. There are a couple of scenes in it, and I think you would enjoy doing it. It's something you haven't done. And I'll send a car for you, and the heater will be on in the dressing room when you come to work. I'm in.
Okay, you hear that, George? You heard it here first. Okay. So that's great. That's great. Well, you know, I understand that you took on a role of as, and we're going to be talking to your husband in a little bit, as an executive producer for a feature-length documentary film entitled Weaving the Past, Journey of Discovery.
Yeah.
And so this was written, directed, and produced by your husband, Walter Dominguez. Is that correct?
That's correct. In the early 60s, I was the youngest female legit producer in Los Angeles. I produced the West Coast premiere of Tennessee Williams' Sweet Bird of Youth. So I knew from producing. And also, it was a part of my creative brain that I wanted to get back to, because it encompasses so much. It's daunting now because of all the new technical and technology things that I had to learn. And it changes in a nanosecond. I'm not going to go into it now because it'll tire my brain, but there's so many different aspects to it. And I was working on Will and Grace when my husband first started this. We finally completed this after 12 years, but it has been a journey of discovery. And it's been so gratifying and so wonderful to work with my husband, because he's really an extraordinary human being. He's really amazing.
Yeah.
All the children and animals just gravitate towards him. He's the kindest person I've ever known in my life.
That's awesome.
And what he's done is he's done a film that will help people to reconnect. You get tired of coming out of a film humming the car crashes.
Right.
And this tells a story. There's history.
Right.
You laugh. You cry.
Right.
Young kids who see it want to stay up all night talking about it.
Right.
That's a gift to us, their reaction.
Absolutely. And I'm looking forward to talking to him shortly right here. And, you know, when you were talking about crying, I got to tell you something. And I want to share this with the audience. When I read this about what happened to you, not that long ago, it almost made my heart skip in unbelief, in awe, and the awesome power of what I know as God, the Almighty, the Divine, the Great Creator, in the orchestration of what happens in our lives. So let me share this with the audience a little bit. So my understanding is that you were inducted into the Bronx Walk of Fame.
Oh, yeah.
Where a street, now listen, folks, listen to this, where a street sign bearing her name was unveiled on 159th Street and Grand Concourse Boulevard. She has joined the ranks of past honorees, Secretary of State Colin Powell, filmmaker Stanley Kubrick, and talk show host Regis Philbin in the street naming tradition. Having the city of New York honor her was such an enormous thrill, was pretty emotional to you, and receiving that recognition must have been just so touching. What reached me and grasped me and just made me just step back was that the sign that bore your name, is bearing your name, that's there, is in full view of an apartment window where your aunts...
Yeah, Tante Ida and Uncle Jack.
And Uncle lived.
Uncle Jack, yeah. Yeah.
And where you spent so many times playing pinochle with them.
Yeah.
When I heard that, when I read that, it just brought back, for me, many times, memories with my parents and my aunt and uncle playing either pinochle or Pedro or whatever. And I just, you know,
I was left speechless. I can you tell me a little bit about what that meant to you?
Well, that's not something, when my agent called me to tell me that they wanted me, they were going to honor me, I said, what? I mean, this is not something you campaign for. And for this to happen was, my husband did a short film on that whole adventure. And people can go to ShellyMorrison.com and see the little film on that.
Perfect, perfect.
The people, oh my God, they were so wonderful. They had a parade, they had a big dinner. We got to meet the most extraordinary people. And Grand Marshal Flash, whatever, that wonderful musical group, they were coming up to me and saying how much they loved me on Willing Grace. It was very heady. It was very heady, and we had a wonderful driver. Jose was our driver, and Jose is Dominican. And so whenever we had some time off or we didn't have to be at a function, we'd ask Jose to take us where he and his family eat. And it was an extraordinary experience. And, it's once in a lifetime. It's once in a lifetime. You can be nominated for this, you're nominated for that, and then you buy ads, and you do this, and you buy fancy clothes. And this was something that came from something deep.
Yeah.
And I clasped to my bosom with hoops of steel. You know, it's wow.
What an amazing story, huh?
Incredible.
Just
and
incredible story. Incredible story.
Posthumously, they honored Bobby Darin that year.
Mm-hmm.
And John Patrick Shanley, wonderful playwright who won the Oscar for Moonstruck. And it was, like, what am I doing here? And they made me feel so welcoming. And it was, and there it is right in front of Aunt Ida and Uncle Jack's apartment building.
That just blew my mind. Call it serendipity. Call it what you will. I believe things are orchestrated the way they're supposed to be. And many times we don't know exactly how it's going to play out, but it does play out. And if we're open to that and we're open to the spirit, then it's going to happen. And, you know, I truly believe that people that are I've had wonderful people on this show that are Hollywood legends and wonderful, just blessed people, just wonderful people. And you can just tell that they march to a different drummer and they get it. Some people do not get it. And some people do get it. And you are one of those people that get it. And so I honor you. I thank you so much for joining us today. I could talk to you forever. We've been talking for probably 35, 40 minutes now. But again, Shelly, on behalf of us here, on behalf of Live from the Bay with Joey, I just want to thank you so much for joining us.
Oh,
and sharing your heart, really. And if I could adopt you as an aunt, I would.
Could. What the hell? You know, why not?
Yeah, why not? So, and thank Lori for setting this up as well. So, again, you're welcome back anytime. God bless you. Thank you so much for joining us. And right now, we're going to be looking forward to talking to your husband. So, again, Shelly, thank you on behalf of us here.
Thank you, sweetheart.
Ladies and gentlemen, filmmaker Walter Dominguez is a wonderful Hollywood writer. He's a producer. He's a director. And we have the honor of having him here with us today. He also happens to be the husband of Shelly Morrison, so that's a great thing. But we want you to just talk more about his new full-length documentary film entitled Weaving the Past, Journey of Discovery. And folks, after hearing about all this and hearing more about what was in this film and what the background was, I just would encourage you to just listen and watch the film and just find out more about this. And I'm just really excited to be able to talk to him today about this film. So, Walter, are you there with us?
Can you hear me?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
I hear you loud and clear.
Perfect, perfect. So I want to know about this film. I know you started in 2001, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Shortly after the 9/11 event.
Okay.
So actually 2002, 2001, I consider it when, like so many other people, life changed, shook you to the core, made you feel so incredibly sad and wondering about the state of the world and where it's going.
Yes.
And, I was 50, and my father was diagnosed with heart disease that was incurable. He was becoming very ill. My dad was somebody I was extremely close to. My wife had some health issues. Lost a best friend to sudden stroke. So there were a number of things happening in and around that time that really, really plunged me into a crossroads in my life. And I needed to turn to something to restore my, because I'd always been a very positive, energetic, outgoing, and always had a sense of goal. And, you know, but I was really, really at a crossroads, feeling lost. So what came to me is the spirit of my grandfather, and this man was an incredibly inspirational and spiritual man with faith in a higher being that I think few people really have that level of faith and trust. So, I needed something like that. I needed to tap into that level of security or feeling of everything's going to be okay. Everything is, comes together. It works out, And so I started wondering and thinking about him a lot. And as I did, I came to realize there were some very important things about his life I really didn't know. And suddenly I became filled with the desire to find these things out, to really flesh out his life. I knew him as a boy for the first 25 years of my life. He was alive, and I knew him as a child. He was very close to me, even as an infant. And so, but as I grew up, I realized, well, this marvelous man didn't just sprout out of nowhere. He
had
come from somewhere, and the more I looked into it, the more I realized he came out of very, very difficult circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
And these circumstances became, as I looked into it more and more, became really astonishing to me. It was a whole world and people I didn't know about. And I realized that not only was his life difficult in his first 25 years of life, but it was amazing. And he and the people he was involved with did amazing, incredible things. And it changed my life.
Yeah, I that's amazing. Thank you for sharing that. I mean, when I was looking at the background on this, there's a few things that stood out. Number one, you're Hispanic. Your family is Mexican, I understand. And I understand that your grandfather was a Methodist preacher. Now, being
yes.
that I'm, Spanish and Italian, I had a lot of people ask me, if your family's from Spain and Italy, how come you're not Roman Catholic? And I said, well, they converted. And so I was christened United Methodist. So when I read this, I was like, oh, man. And my uncles were preachers, so I could totally relate to this whole thing. And
wow.
And, yeah. And that's why I had told Shelley, I said, you'll find out more about why this rung so deep within my soul reading this, and I did my research on it, and the whole story about who he was, your grandfather, and how you were with him for, well, I at one point you lived with him and his new wife, I understand.
Yeah.
After your grandmother passed away. And
right.
and I understand that you saw some miraculous, see, people don't understand that. When you work in the miraculous things happen. Like, for
mm-hmm.
instance, he didn't have a Christmas tree for Christmas one year. They prayed about it, all of a sudden this Christmas tree appears, right?
I was staying with him up in the Central Valley. He had a little church up there. He was semi-retired at the time, and they gave him a kind of an impossible church, that didn't have
right.
any means, really. It was a very poor area. So there was no money. There was no money to buy a Christmas tree for the church. And I was like, I was so upset. Have to have a Christmas tree in the church.
Absolutely.
So I kept after and after. And finally, he just said, don't worry, God provides. We'll, you know. So we took a drive. We went to go see a friend. And a big truck came down from the Sierra Nevada mountains laden with Christmas trees on their way to the markets. And just as the truck went by us, it hit a bump, and a big tree fell right out the back of the truck.
Amazing.
My grandfather pulled over. He put the tree in the car, and that was it. You know, the gift came. Truck was long gone. It never even knew what happened. We could never chase it down. So there was the tree. And that was typical. I mean, there was another time when we literally ran out of food, you know,
right.
Because he didn't get paid all that much. And,
right.
As I said, there weren't many people in the congregation. I think there were a
right.
few. One of them, I think, was a homeless man who just, you know, would go there to keep warm in the church.
Right.
Bless his heart. And but my grandmother, my step-grandmother, was like, well, we have these two young kids, you know, they can't go without food. And he said, don't worry. That same day, a couple of people showed up to visit him with grocery bags full of food. So this is the sort of thing that happened almost on a daily basis.
Right, right. And I believe, and I, you know, just because of the tradition I'm from and what I believe in spiritually, I believe that this is very possible to every day of our lives as
mm-hmm.
long as we're open to it, as long as we're in the right frame. And, you know, when in reading this about what a blessing to have a grandson that would be able to honor your grandfather with this movie. And, you know, that in itself speaks worlds about who you are. And I think it will go out and reach people that it will create a faith in people, and they'll understand really what it really means to go from maybe a dark side of life
mm-hmm.
to a lighter side of life. And that's really what happened in the story of your grandfather, and
yeah.
probably those things that you were, you know, maybe as a child that you said, Grandpa, tell me a little bit more about your past, and he didn't want to share too much,
yeah.
maybe because it was dark to him.
Yeah.
It was a past that maybe he didn't want to remember.
Yeah.
But you know what? You kind of uncovered that. Now, Walter, I want to ask you, in your research on this, which took years, and going back to the village and going back to, now tell me about this, that I know that there was a haunting picture of a friend of his.
Yes.
That
Proxidus Guerrero.
Uh-huh.
He was a young man. Well, first of all the years growing up, I really hadn't heard about him. It
right.
wasn't until my grandfather died, and he gave a photograph, a special photograph. It was inside a leather wallet kind of a thing,
mm-hmm.
very old, and he gave it to my mother before he died to take care of it. He was my best friend growing up, and he'd carried it with him. It was like a thin leather thing that you could put in your pocket. He literally carried it everywhere with him, wherever he went, for decades. And so obviously when I interviewed my mom to get information about the family, and she just mentions during the interview that this photograph exists. And I'd really been into the photographs in the family, and I thought I'd seen all of them. And when I heard about that, I had to see it. Well, the photograph somehow disappeared, and so my mom, we looked for it, my dad looked for it, and we're getting very upset. And finally, my mom prayed. And the following day, the picture fell on my dad's head. It was in a box, a little shoebox, on top of a cabinet. And it fell on his head, and there he opened it up, and there was the photograph. So
wow.
He called me. He was so excited. And I rushed over to go see it, Shelley and I did, and there was this amazing young man, very handsome, very amazing expression in his eyes. And I started doing research because we did know his name. And it turned out he is one of Mexico's revolutionary heroes and an extraordinary young man, a journalist, a poet,
mm-hmm.
And an activist and union organizer and ultimately a revolutionary. And this was the young man that my grandfather came to know when my grandfather ran away from home at the age of five and ended up at the age of five starting to work on a hacienda and living there. And this is the young man he came to know, and they became very close. They came together along with other group of young men to the United States to escape persecution, political persecution, from their activities to oppose the dictatorship there, which was increasingly oppressive and really awful, and came to the Southwest and then Los Angeles. And we're talking 1904. So it was quite a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
And but they did some remarkable things, and I think they were incredibly brave. And I didn't know any of this growing up until I did the research. A series of miraculous things. Again, as you were saying, when you are open to allowing the universe to bring you things, to give you gifts, if you have a strong intention and you have a strong belief behind it, things begin to come. Doors open and things come through the doors that just blow you away. So,
but you have to have ears to hear.
Yes. Yes,
you have
do.
To have ears to hear. You have to have eyes to see. If you don't, these things will pass you by.
Mm-hmm.
And but if you're tuned in, then miraculous and wonderful things can happen. So I know that in seeing this picture, it kind of inspired you. Now, what I'm wondering in the back of my mind, even though I know that when they asked your grandfather who this man was, and he said this was a dear friend of mine, do you know whether or not he ever did see him again after he went from that the life that your grandfather, and you know, for those that we don't want to take the whole documentary away, you know, we want people to eventually be able to see this. So what I'm asking you is, do you know whether or not your grandfather ever saw him again?
Well, what happened is that and this I can say because it's a historical fact, so anybody who can look up this person online can find out. This young man that my grandfather looked up to, my grandfather was 5 years younger than he, was killed tragically he went to Mexico with a group of men, and they were trying to get the revolution going, kind of incite it. And unfortunately, when you engage in armed conflict, the result can be being killed or wounded, and so he was killed. And so my grandfather was devastated, I'm sure, by it. I mean, every evidence that I have is that he fell into a kind of a crisis deeper than even the one I had been in. And through the appearance of these amazingly compassionate and caring young missionaries, in this case they happened to be Methodist, in downtown Los Angeles. My grandfather was destitute, depressed, alcoholic, living in the park, Central Park there, and at the plaza where the homeless people would often gather and sleep.
Mm.
You know, he just sank into such despair after his only family and his the young man he hero worshipped and worked with and died in this tragic way. I think it just destroyed him. So, but through the help of these people, he pulled out of it. He tapped into something deep, and he tapped into spirit, into God, and that became his sustenance for the rest of his life. And he never looked back. It's amazing. I never saw this man, my grandfather, ever show any fear or anxiety about anything. He was just in such total faith. I've never encountered anyone like that ever since. So I think what happened is as I started learning about him and started going deeper and trying to put myself into his shoes, into his life, I drew on some of that. And I think a certain level of faith started to build up again. And as that happened, gifts started coming my way.
You know, and that will follow you. You know, once a soul like that has touched your life, I mean, they've touched, you know, people like that have touched my life,
yeah.
Family members, pastor, what have you. But once those people have touched your life and you really see the Creator, the Divine, God,
mm-hmm.
the Almighty,
mm-hmm.
working through them,
mm-hmm.
it will forever change your life. It just will. because you will see that they are maneuvered and manipulated and guided by something great, far greater than themselves. And that's what this story spoke to me about, was about a man that, like you said, he never looked back. And he moved and he touched people's lives. And he was able to dramatically, you know, obviously he went home to be with his creator in 1973. Is that correct?
Yes.
And but you know that story still lives through you, and that you know that part of your grandfather will forever live in your life. And as you continue, and that's what's the beauty about this documentary, is that you know this is still. What a great story in honor of your grandfather. And I'm sure if he was still with us, and of course in spirit, you know, he'd be so proud of his grandson for doing
you.
This.
Thank you. I do feel. I just watched the film yesterday. We did a test screening at a theater over here in one of the old film studios. Just to test the soundtrack, we had a problem with the soundtrack in the last screening, so we were testing it to get the glitches out, and everything worked perfectly. And I'm watching the film, and I just got into the film, and it really, I got very emotional. Although I've seen the film all the way through probably about 6,200 times, and I got very emotional because it hit me that I have done something to really, really honor these ancestors.
Absolutely.
Including especially my grandfather, but also there are other characters in the film who are elders, and they're all there now. They've all passed away, but they're there, and they've been honored, and I did my best to work with people to make it as artistic and as entertaining and interesting as possible, and I feel good about that. I mean, it really is a validation inside in a quiet way. I just feel good about myself, what I've done, because I do feel I have done something in tribute. And I encourage everyone out there, you know, even if it's just taking your iPhone and recording on video an interview with one of your family seniors, you're going to feel good about that, especially when they're no longer
right.
And you'll be so glad you did that.
Right.
And I encourage everyone to honor their ancestors, you know.
Yeah, that's...
One of the first, I don't know if it's the first ten of the Ten Commandments, but it's one of them, and it's honor thy father and thy mother.
Yeah, absolutely.
And extend
absolutely.
It to your grandparents and your aunts and uncles and your mentors, your teachers, whoever, like you said, changed your life. And
absolutely.
With something that never changes, it's always there for you.
Absolutely. And, you know, this is the first time you and I have ever spoken, so I'm going to go out on a limb here. But what I do sense in the spirit is that in your travels in this 12 years or however long it took to put this thing together, my sense is that you've had some encounters with some people that forever changed your life. Is that correct?
Yes.
Tell me about that.
Well, there was one wonderful, she comes near the end of the film, this woman who probably was near 100 years old that I discovered, I was led to, and in the most amazing circumstance. And she just touched my heart so deeply. And it turned out she knew my grandmother, my great-grandmother, and I had been looking for any connection to my grandfather's parents, his mother, and because that was one of his dying wishes. Another dying wish was to find his family in Mexico. And my mom wanted to do that, my dad, but they were unable to do it, so it fell on me. It was very powerful how that happened. People talk about her and my step-grandmother, Teresita, after the film was over. They think about those two elderly ladies because they're so full of incredible wisdom, compassion, love, humor. Just amazing ladies. And they're both almost 100. and they're both gone now.
Mm.
So people think of them a lot, and so you know, she was one of the persons I felt really changed my life. There was just something about her I'll never forget, and it was wonderful. And she was my direct link to my great grandmother, so because they were good friends,
wow.
lived next to each other,
wow.
and believe me, it was so totally out of the blue, and it was truly a miraculous meeting, and the film depicts it. So I don't want to say too much about it because it's really a marvelous part of the story, of the film.
So let me ask you, when will people be able to see the film? Do you know, do we have an idea when this will be?
Well, like so many documentary films, you know, we make it a work of love and passion,
right, right.
and commitment, and you,
right.
you know, you're so busy making it, you don't have a distributor lined up and all this, unless you're somebody, you know, who's made a lot of really documentaries that have made a lot of money or done pretty well, you know, you're not going to have distribution lined up. So what you do is you find audiences, and you find ways to create opportunities to show it.
Mm-hmm.
And in my case, we've already received invitations to screen it in San Antonio, Texas. They have a couple of cultural centers and a university that are really interested. So we're trying to figure out how to combine all those and maybe, you know, get a larger theater, that kind of a thing. The Bay Area, there are people who are writing that they would like to see it screened up there. So we're just doing a gradual rollout, and at some point, hopefully, it will be in a film festival and one that might attract people from the distribution industry who might be interested. But so many of the filmmakers today are self-distributing because of the access to the internet and social media and everything. So that's also a possibility that it would be available down the road is on demand, video on demand, and as DVDs, so there'll be ways for people to see it. In the meantime, they can go to the website, and through the website there are a number of video clips posted, so
mm-hmm.
they can get a sense of moments from the film, and then enjoy it that way until such time as it hopefully will come to their region.
Right. And I believe that website is weavingthepast.com. Is that correct?
Correct.
Weavingthepast.com, folks. So if you want to see those clips. And, you know, I'd love to see it out here, like either at a film festival. I know in the Bay Area there's a cultural center. I'm trying to think of the name of it. In Berkeley, I think it's La Peña or something. That might be something that you might want to. I'd love mm-hmm. to see it out here. I mean, there's so many, and there's a big Hispanic community here as
mm-hmm.
well, as you know. So
yeah. Well, what I'd love to do is when an opportunity happens and we're doing it, we're going to screen it in the Bay Area, that if I can let you know about it, would love to have you come, but also maybe we could talk about it on air so other people could hear about it.
Oh, that would be great. I would be honored, and I would love that to occur. So, you know, hopefully that'll happen very soon, and I'm really looking forward to that. So, again, folks, the website is weavingthepast.com. And again, Walter, this has been so refreshing for me, and for me, it's hit home in a lot of ways, because, you know, there's some tie with what I've gone through personally in my own life, and having some, you know, like I said, I mean, my uncles were preachers, and of course I'm of Spanish ancestry, and not being Catholic was odd. You know, I've heard this
yeah.
all my life. How could you not be Catholic? You know,
and yeah, I know. I've gone through that too. But you know, surprisingly, there are a number of Latinos who come from family traditions that are different. Sephardics
right.
or
right.
or Spanish Jews or
right.
Protestants or, you know, so people, yeah, I know what you're saying, but it is a unique thing, and I would love to actually talk to you sometime when we're not on the air. Just, I'd love to hear more about your family background.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, I'll tell you what, do you have a pen handy here?
Do.
So my email address, and then we can exchange information, is livewithjoey@hotmail.com. And then when we go off the air, well, let's see. Bud Jammin, who's our audio producer, can take down your information. How about that?
That's great.
And then, you know, he can get
after it goes, after it mutes.
Yeah, and then you'll be able to talk to him, and he'll get your information. And I would love to, because, you know, I really believe, and this is one of those instances in life when things are presented to us, and they come our way, and we just we step back and we go, okay, okay, God, okay, Creator,
mm-hmm.
okay, Almighty.
Mm-hmm.
This person was meant to come my way. This person, the story was meant to go forth. And you know what? You don't know. This broadcast here will go into on demand, and it's
mm-hmm.
going to be replayed. You don't know who is going to hear this,
exactly.
and you don't know who it's going to touch. And that's how life is. You know, we never know. You know, the whole
what's around the corner.
What's
and it's
around the corner?
Be something wonderful, you know.
You know, I mean, we just don't know, we don't know about it. I mean, we just were, you know, Shelley was sharing her stories, and you know, they were so. I mean, I've had many things that have happened to me in my life. 2.5 years ago, I started writing a short film about a Sephardic Jewish family.
Wow.
That's going to be a short, you know, a short film. I mean, that's what we're hoping that. And, you know, and it's taken a lot of time and research, and I've engulfed myself into that whole tradition, and I'm doing a show on it. But, and, you know, and then we have Shelley on, and, you know, we don't know how the people that cross our path, look at what you did in honor of your grandfather, and then you come on this show, and it just so happens that I was christened United Methodist, you know, raised Methodist, and then, you know, hearing about the story, and just there's so many parallels. So thank
yeah,
you so much. Thank you so much. And again, folks, please go to the website. Again, it's weavingthepast.com. Again, weavingthepast.com. Walter, I want to thank you so much for joining us. Hang tight with Jammin a little for a little bit. He'll
sure.
get your information. Again, thank you for joining us today. And ladies and gentlemen, just a round of applause for Walter Dominguez. And again, go to his website, hear about this, let him know how much you appreciate what he's doing and his work. And if you know people that can be instrumental in getting the word out, please do that, okay? Because we never know, and you never know who knows who. And so that's the way this world goes. So thanks. Thanks again. Hold tight. So, folks, thank you so much. This has just been a pleasure having both Shelley and Walter here with us today. I mean, it's just been just amazing. Their stories have inspired, blessed, you know, everything that Shelley talked about was just so incredible. Her 50 plus years in the film industry, motion picture, television industry, you know, how she has been honored and all that, and now the tradition that she's a part of, and how both her and her husband have spiritually adopted these children and what their beliefs are and what they stand on, and how Walter has honored his grandfather, and that story will definitely touch many, many people moving forward. So again, I want to thank them so much for what they're doing and how they've helped and how they're going to help other people moving forward with this documentary. And they do a lot of great work currently now within their own community in Los Angeles. So truly two wonderful people that have blessed many, many people. So anyway, a couple of other hot topics that I wanted to talk about. I'm going to talk really quick about these things, and then we're going to have Jammin join us too. But one that really stuck with me, and this is, again, talking about helping people, The story was, if science gives people superpowers, will they use them for good or for evil? So, you know, it was kind of interesting. They did this study last year at Stanford, and they recruited 60 volunteers to experiment on how virtual superpowers could influence moral decision. And in an immersive virtual reality simulation, 30 of the subjects were granted the power of flight, and 30 rode as passengers in a helicopter. And each volunteer had the same mission, to cruise over a city following an earthquake in search of stranded child. And this child was diabetic. So the, you know, the goal was to get the child the medication, the insulin, to save his life. And after the simulation, the experimenters sat down to debrief each subject, and they talked. And so, Jamin, I don't know, can you hear me? Are you here with us now? Are you back in the with
yes,
us here?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, great.
Yes, I am.
So I don't know how much of this you heard, but it's interesting. After the simulation, an experimenter sat down to debrief each subject. And as they talked, the experimenter accidentally knocked over a canister full of pens and then waited 5 seconds before beginning to pick those pens up. And the volunteers in the helicopter group took an average of 6 seconds to start helping clean up the spill. And some didn't pitch in at all. And this was done right here in Stanford. But those in the Superman group jumped right in. And immediately. So, and some even before the experimenter actually dropped the pen. So these were people that had these, you know, these virtual glasses on, and they were actually, I saw it, you can actually see this on the internet, where they were actually virtually flying over a city, like Superman, in search of the child. And then when they found the child, they were to give the child the insulin that the child needed to prevent that child from dying. Pretty amazing stuff, huh?
Yes, it is.
I mean, that's just, but, you know, science is, they're saying that they're getting close to giving people the ability to have superpowers. I mean, that's kind of scary in one instance, right? I mean, you want, I mean, it's cool to think that, you know, there's a possibility that we would be able to be given powers to help people out. But, you know, on the other hand, would people utilize those powers for evil? You know, we just never know. I mean, that's what's a little bit scary, right?
Definitely. I mean, that's an interesting subject.
Yeah, it is. And then let's take it a step further, talking about things that really disturb me, that I believe are kind of the potential of evil. Did you hear about this now, that there is now people, and I hate to even give this my 5 cents, but I'm very, I'm not really too cool with this, and I want to know what your thoughts are about this. People will now have, or there's the first 3D printed gun is now, people will be able to get blueprints for this. This just blows my mind. So there's actually a printer that can utilize plastic, and people can get these blueprints, and this plastic gun is created. Now,
okay.
That's pretty scary, isn't it?
So they're actually creating a real plastic gun that actually works?
Yep. It is known as a Liberator. It's a 16-piece firearm, made almost entirely of ABS plastic, with a metal firing pin, an embedded metal shank. You know, I mean, I'm sorry, but, you know, there's definitely something wrong here, you know, on the way I view this. This is scary stuff. This is not. I mean, this is, I couldn't believe I had seen something written about this. But then this, on May 6th, this came out, NBC News. What do you think about that?
That's just crazy. So people are going to be able to print their own guns, right? Their own firearms.
Well, hopefully not, but the technology is there.
Well, the printer itself has got to be ridiculously expensive, and you know, I'm sure not everybody's going to have one of those in their home, or you know, or easily accessible to a printer that can print that, you know.
Right, right. And I just, you know, I think I've probably given this enough time as I want to give it, but really, I mean, people need to be careful out there, and this is not something that we want to see readily available. Whether it's blueprints or otherwise, I think this is kind of dangerous stuff. And on another note, you know, we were talking about your favorite friend, Justin, and, oh, yeah, mine too, right, Mr. Bieber. And, you know, we heard the story last week, and now there's yet another one while he was in Dubai, and he was fined for speeding. This guy, I mean, I just don't understand. Last week it was him making his little mark at the Anne Frank Center and, you know, making his little comment and his marketing ploy like, you know, hopefully Anne Frank or, you know, would have been a believer. And now, you know, something else. And it's just like I'm thinking to myself, is this guy going to ever stop? Or is he hiring or are his publicity people creating these stories just to have him constantly in our face? But it's getting kind of a little bit old, right?
Oh, man, that's crazy. Hey, I just got to clear up one thing. He is not my friend.
oh, he's not?
I thought you guys hung out.
I'm sorry. No?
Hey, you know, there's one word that comes to mind when every time you bring him up on the show. The word is egocentric. Does that ring a bell for you?
Yeah. Somebody that just he... Yeah, it's kind of sad, isn't it? I mean, it seems like he has to always be the center. Well, especially that one last week where he's at the Anne Frank Center, and then he writes in there, you know, I'm sure, you know, she was, I mean, he pays tribute to her on one end, and then he turns around and he turns it into a big marketing thing for himself, or so it seems, right? So that in itself really... you know, just was kind of scary. And then just hearing this one just is the same thing. It's like, my God, it seems like every week I'm hearing something else, you know, about this guy. And, you know, last week I was on my bandwagon about those bags here. Remember that?
Yeah, I do.
And I was telling the guy that invented... So, folks, it just seems like in different cities, especially here in the San Francisco Bay Area, there are people that are cities that have now started charging for bags. So if you go to the store, you go to the grocery store, you go to any store, you want a bag, you're going to have to pay for it, okay? And they're not necessarily these plastic bags. They're paper bags. But can I just tell you that I just once again had another instance where I paid 10 cents for this bag to store these items that I got at a drugstore, and I'm not going to say the name of the drugstore. Do you know that no sooner did I pick it up, the whole thing broke? I mean, it just came apart. I mean, it was
did
like...
Did they give you your 10 cents back?
Heck no, they gave me another bag.
Okay, there you go.
You know, I mean, that 10 cents is going to that store. You do know that. And then, you know, the store is telling the employees, oh, no, this goes to the city. And the city is denying it. I don't care who it goes to. I mean, this is so annoying. And I am on strike. So if I have to drive 10 miles from where I live, I don't give a rip. I'm going to drive 10 miles from where I live to not have to pay that 10-cent charge for that bag if it carries me till September or October before that city and itself starts on their little bag charge or whatever. I don't care. But, you know, the bags are absolutely worthless and crappy. And I just say whoever, you know, if that person that came up with this idea, they really need to bag it. You know, they need to bag it because it's just terrible. I mean, you're going grocery shopping, you either have to bring your own bags, right, or you have to buy their bags. And, you know,
I have a question. How many bags do you have to bring? How do you know how much you're going to purchase? You know, like,
is this a
like
trick
like
question?
Me.
Is this a trick question?
I don't know. I'm just bringing it up for discussion. When I go to the store, I usually go to the store hungry, you know. So I might be going to buy one or two items, and all of a sudden I walk out of there with a, you know, with a half a cart or something. And maybe I only came in with one bag for my one or two items. And now I've, you know, what am I going to do now? I mean, tell me, what should I do now with only one bag?
You know, I don't know. And, you know, think about this. Is it really sanitary bringing in bags that you've had, or say you even purchased them? Say you go to the store and they go, you know what, we have a bag. We have a heavy-duty bag. We'll sell to you for $1.50 to put your stuff in, okay? All right, now you paid $1.50 for this heavy-duty bag, okay? That's great, and it does serve the purpose. It holds your groceries. It holds everything. It's heavy-duty. But then guess what? You find out that it's not sanitary. It's contaminated. So every time you go to use this bag, you go back to the store. My God, you see what I'm saying? Do you understand? And I guess maybe I'm super, you know, super paranoid on this because, as you know, I've been in the pharmaceutical industry as a hospital rep for years. I know about germs. I dealt with products, selling products that dealt with antibiotics that dealt with pathogens, and I know how quickly that spreads, you know. And so we really need to be cognizant of that. And so it just doesn't. I mean, it's just, you know, it's bad, man. I just, and so I'm kind of like blown away. I just don't know what I'm to do. So I think what I'm going to do right now for at least the next few months is go to these cities where I don't have to pay this extra bag tax. I'm not that cheap, but, you know, when I'm buying groceries, folks, you know, it's not just one or two bags, you know. So I'm buying a few groceries, and it's going to be a lot of bags, you know. Yeah, so, I mean, what do you do? Do you just, I mean, the city that you live in has this nice, thank you very much, bag tax. So what do you bring in? Do you bring in an old bag? No pun intended. But do you bring an old bag in? I mean,
well,
what do you do?
I have cloth nylon type bags. I keep one in my car. You know, a lot of times I'm just going in for a couple items or something. You know, my wife does all the shopping. So I'm grateful that I'm removed from this because I very seldom ever remember to bring the bag in. And, you know, you talk about the sanitary thing. I was thinking, I wonder if that giant snail has ever been in one of those bags that you're using, you know?
I don't know. But, you know, if you ever see one of these giant snails, and we were talking about this earlier, folks, this story is from Texas. These nasty-looking big snails are actually from Africa. They are dangerous. They carry the meningitis virus. So if you see anything like that, just be assured it's not a big mushroom in your garden. That itself, if you see something that big, you know, with little horns walking around, I would run, you know what I'm saying? I mean, that thing is, it's scary, man. Town affected by giant snails, right? I mean, this is the next, it's like, oh my God, you heard of the birds, now it's the snails. So anyway.
Hey, we also have giant snakes in Florida. People bring them from South America as pets.
Oh, that's right.
You know, then all of a sudden they grow up. I just heard about this week. They grow up and they become these huge, huge snakes, and people don't know what to do with them anymore. They were fine when they were little pets. So
right.
They take them out, you know, to the Everglades or wherever, and they turn them loose. So there is a guy, I know, there is a guy that is hired full-time. He hunts these things down and gets rid of them.
Are you serious?
I'm serious. I'm serious on this. I just heard about this.
That's
crazy, man.
Yeah, that is crazy. That is totally, totally crazy. Well, you know, on that, I think we should just wrap it up. And again, you know, Jamin, I, you know, having Shelley and Walter here with us today was such a, it was just really nice. And what nice people, and just a wonderful story. Both had wonderful stories, real inspirations. You know, again, wonderful people that have come our way and touched our lives, and of course are going to be able to touch many other people's lives. So I'm sure it was very encouraging for you as well to hear their stories today. So on that, I will say, folks, till the next time, on behalf of us, Live from the Bay with Joey, on behalf of myself and Jammin', we thank you for joining us. We look forward to hearing and talking to you and having you tune in next time next week. So until then, take care.
Thank you for joining us today on Live from the Bay with Joey.